We're talking about our rural communities around the state shrinking and what to do about it. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two-thirds of Wisconsin rural communities lost residents between 2010 and 2018. That's according to a recent report. And this downward population trend is expected to worsen over the next decade. So do you live in rural Wisconsin? Have you noticed your neighbors moving away? How has the dwindling population in your community affected your work, your school, your church? Where have you found silver linings in all of this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. It's based in Rhinelander. The public-private partnership organization focuses on workforce issues in eight northern counties. Brittany, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
What are you seeing as so many rural communities are losing members of the heartbeat of their community? What is taking place with this population loss?
Well, I think we're at a moment where our local officials are starting to wake up to the fact that we all need to work together to solve this problem. We actually are seeing some major manufacturers expand, and we have some real critical housing issues that we need to then figure out so that we can welcome more people back into our communities. So, yes, we've seen some people leave, but we're actually at this moment where we know people want to come to our areas because it's actually a great place to find a live-work balance, and we have it here to offer.
Quality of life is good, you're saying, and you're also seeing jobs coming into the communities. What's going on with housing?
Housing is very tight. We're at this area in time where it's been 10 years since the 2008 stock market crash. And we've seen a lot of developers leave the industry, so everything is very tight. We need to expand a lot of our rental units. We don't necessarily have that stock in our mix. We also need quality entry-level housing, and people are starting to work together to figure this out.
So you're working with communities, working with businesses. Besides housing, what are the other barriers rural communities are facing right now?
Broadband is absolutely something that we are working together with our economic development officials at the county level to really address. Broadband is not necessarily just broadband, just connectivity. It's also cellular reception. So, for example, we can't have Uber or Lyft in the North Woods because we have these big pockets where we need connectivity. A lot of it is actually solved. We just need to start working on the connectivity in those little patches. And communities that really need to get on the bandwagon of figuring it out for themselves. A perfect example is Forest County has been working together, really worked to create a coalition of individuals who are going to be working on it, and they put together a multi-million dollar PSC grant in the last round, really taking it seriously.
Brittany Beyer is with us, Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation, looking at workforce issues in eight counties in the northern part of the state. You can join in. How has depopulation of rural Wisconsin affected you, your job or your business? Is the economy struggling where you are? Is it healthy in your rural county? What can be done to help? Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Brittany, there are 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. Are the tribal nations in the northern part of the state seeing a decrease in population as well?
You know, I actually reached out to a couple of the different tribes in the area. There are three tribal nations in the Grow North region. They hold their information a little bit differently. I do know for a fact that Lac des Flambeaux is increasing, and it's actually a very young population. So that puts a real need for looking at the education system, standing up to the fact that they need to have really good education. I know the Lac des Flambeaux is also looking at their housing, but they also actually are taking a real big forward look at entrepreneurship. And I'm going to be really interested in seeing how that plays out for them in the future.
When you look at rural communities and you look at the issue of diversity, are some residents of color leaving because they don't see other people like them? Or is that an issue at all?
I think we're going to see diversity issues come up in the future. I think the timber here in the Northwoods is that it's a very welcoming area, but that's not to say that we are going to have to address any interactions with some real care. It's actually something that I've actually talked to, especially in figuring out some of our construction shortages. If we are going to figure out some of our problems, we need to look at the diversity of the population that is coming in. We're not necessarily seeing them leave, but we need to really be welcoming in that way.
Let's bring in a call now. Kathy is with us from Sparta this morning. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add a comment about the availability of quality childcare in rural areas and how that affects workforce in areas where we live in western Wisconsin. We're finding that a lot of times individuals would like to move to communities, rural communities, because of that quality of life. But a lot of times barriers to quality childcare for their children affects whether or not they actually move here. So just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Kathy, thank you for doing so. So access to daycare is an issue,
yeah.
Kathy wants to bring up. Brittany?
It absolutely is. It's actually something that's really top of mind. We're going to be having a workforce cultivation conference in May on the 20th at Nicolet College. And actually, just yesterday, I was talking to some healthcare professionals. The question is bringing in the businesses to help figure out that problem, either through a voucher system or really taking a lead and expanding it. We are seeing shrinking access to childcare, and it's critical at this point.
Governor Evers created the Office of Rural Prosperity that is overseen by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. What will that office look like in touching the areas, the counties you work with?
Yeah, so I checked in with WEDC since that position or office really was created just really at the end of January. It's still emerging, but what I can tell you is that there's three portions to what they see as that office at this point. They want to create a one-stop shop for resources, which is actually really critical. I'd love to create a resource page on Grow North's website, but the resources, the time, the finances to do that, really hard for me to do, so that's really great that they're doing that. They're going to be looking internally at how they can use some of their programs a little bit better for rural communities. I'll just say sometimes the programs that they have, they're just too big, and what we need is something right-sized, and they're willing to do that with this Office of Rural Prosperity. And the last thing is they're really going to take a look at how they can use the quasi-private partnership structure of WEDC to find the gaps and figure out how they can use the finances and technical assistance that they can offer, tailoring it to the rural communities. So this is going to take a little bit of time, but I'm really hoping that this is something that can really impact our rural communities with more targeted ways of working with us.
We're looking at the nuts and bolts, the rural challenges with population loss. Brittany Beyer is here. She heads up Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. You too, what are your local leaders doing to keep residents living in your county? How is the economy where you are? Are there jobs and the housing isn't there, or the child care isn't there? What could the state offer, some type of incentive to entice people to be able to set down roots in rural parts of the state? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Brittany Beyer here on the Ideas Network.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. We're looking at population trends in rural parts of our state. After a recent report forecast a continued loss of residents in Wisconsin's small towns, and the declines were most acute in Price and Iron counties, situated in the breathtaking natural beauty of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, by the way, has a loss of residents affected your job or your business? Are you working to bring people into your small community? What are your biggest selling points? Bring your pitches, your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation, and she stays with us. So, Brittany, in 2018, Wisconsin ranked 32nd in the nation for internet access. You said earlier that we're making quite a bit of progress. What is the status of connectivity in areas where there are still gaps?
Well, there are just gaps, but the reality is there's places even in the Northwoods where there's really good connectivity. You just have to be very, very specific about where you want to be. We can actually even start looking at the fact that people can work remotely in the area. But the truth is that we need at a federal level to think about it as a utility rather than just some nice feature. And that really switches things so that it becomes like electricity. And then we really need to see something where there's like a rollout that happened in the 1930s with electricity getting to rural communities. It's high time that we do something like that because we're having the problem where we can't get it done without that type of thinking.
Tourism is also a big driver for communities in your area. How is the need to increase broadband access affecting the tourist season?
Well, I can say in some small communities, they can't run credit card machines because of the broadband usage at high season. We're also seeing the time of the staying of people in cabins, even if it's they own them, it's shrinking because if they don't necessarily have the connectivity, it's really July and August and a little bit into September that people are staying. The truth is, again, we need to see all of those resources in broadband and in connectivity be here in the Northwoods. People can choose to turn that off to disconnect because we have all this natural beauty right outside of our doorsteps. And there are ways to do it now. We just want to expand it even further.
But working remotely or going to school remotely, that can be seriously compromised by what you're seeing right now?
Yes. So there was just a report about disadvantages to students in K through 12 if they don't necessarily have access. So not this year, but last year where there were so many days that schools were closed because of the weather, some schools found at least 35% of their students didn't have internet access, which means that they couldn't give them assignments that were online. That becomes a real issue for education. And if we're talking about the workforce of tomorrow, we're not giving them the same advantages.
In particular, in Florence and Langlade counties, data is showing that these counties experienced the largest decline in business establishments. Why are small businesses struggling right now?
Well, if you're looking at that report, a lot of times I look at different reports to get my information. One of the other resources I look at is youreconomy.org, which is actually through the UW Extension. And the invisible part of small businesses is of self-driven businesses, so just like one person working, looks different. And so Langlade County in specific actually has a lot of people who are doing work for themselves. If you're looking at 2010 to 2018, there are a lot of changes in the market that were happening and in our industry. And it's just we're looking at a different time in how we're going to be doing work. We need to be supporting individuals as entrepreneurs in a completely different manner. And that's going to take local municipalities recognizing that there's differences. It takes our economic development corporations recognizing people are working differently. But also, we just have a different look in manufacturing. And right now, we need to look at the people who live in our communities as real great assets. Maybe they need a couple of different skills put into their pockets and have them help us create really great places to live.
Talking with Brittany Beyer, who heads up the Grow North Economic Development Corporation, there are 9 regional economic development partners around the state. We're looking at the workforce issues in the northern part of the state. What can you tell us about your rural community? How is it doing? Is it thriving? What programs are helping key people living in your area? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's look at infrastructure, Brittany. Our rural roads are among the most deteriorated in the country. How is your organization working to help fix aging infrastructure, which could then translate to perhaps more people wanting to stay in an area?
Well, I would say as an organization that has an employee base of 1, right now we're working on housing and workforce cultivation and innovation and entrepreneurship the most. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that transportation is not very important, but we work really closely with some of the individuals who are championing transportation and rail. And the truth is, even our rural communities need rail in order for some of the businesses to survive. And to be honest, a lot of the movement of goods on our roads, they're putting extra stress. So we're working with people who are talking about the need for rail. The mix inside of transportation is absolutely still necessary. So it's more of supporting the individuals who are working on that.
Are you looking for rail and other types of transportation to connect to major city centers, or is it connecting to other rural areas in the vicinity?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
It's transportation of goods, but you know, if we lose a rail and we have a mill that's connected to the rail system, that's really going to make a difference. So we're really needing the expansion of rail services even in our areas, and we need that really understood at the state level.
Let's bring in Pam now in Richland Center with thoughts on this. Hi, Pam. Are you there, Pam?
Hello.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi. Sorry, we have bad cell service out in rural Wisconsin, so my phone might be a little difficult, but that's part of living here. I was just going to bring up one of my issues here: diversity.
And I think we just lost Pam, but wanted to talk about workforce and the issues with diversity. The workforce needs to be more accepting, she says, so people will stay. Pam, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. So, Liz, the nursing home I work at has a shortage of nurses, so...
Oh, dear.
You know, sorry.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to allow Brittany here to respond. And we're hearing from Pam a shortage of nurses. And I'm thinking that they want to bring more people in from all different areas. What are the issues there?
I think it points to a real underbelly issue where we have to be accepting, but we have to think about things in a very open way. I've talked about another project just in the thinking process and bringing in even something like the People's Institute to really address the storytelling of each person having their point of view and making sure that we understand that diversity can be something that is looked at as understanding difference as an asset rather than something that is not an asset. So I absolutely agree with that. And once we understand that we're all trying to get to the same end together, that's a very large part of trying to figure out this troubling issue.
Brittany, before we let you go, the data is showing that Wisconsin's rural communities are shrinking at a slower rate than the national average. What do you think is contributing to that as you look at national trends around the country?
Right. So although it is shrinking, the people who stay or decide to come back have these really strong ties to the areas. And
you too, I may add.
Right. And we want to really make that as part of the asset of why people should be coming back. I've talked a lot about, we don't have a, we have a one aspect of a four-year college with the University of Wisconsin Green Bay Marinette in the Grow North region. So anyone who is K through 12, they're going to leave if they want to get a college education. Our job is to say, welcome back. What have you learned that you can bring back to our communities and make them stronger? That's a very, very, very strong way of making sure that people feel like this is a place for them. And I want to help our local communities get to the place where we're all talking that way.
Brittany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. Coming up, the coronavirus, as more cases surface across the U.S., we prioritize your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll learn more about it after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting briefed now on Wisconsin's response to coronavirus as 11 people in the U.S. have died, cases surfacing across the U.S. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate is expected to quickly take up an $8.3 billion emergency aid bill approved by the House, and President Trump is expected to sign it. Are you concerned about how the U.S. is coping with this? Are you taking your own precautions? What changes have you made in your life? Have you been stocking up on supplies? And if so, what? We're at 800-642-1234 with all your questions. Dr. Nasia Safdar is a professor of infectious disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She is medical director of infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
So the coronavirus has so far only infected one person, one resident in Wisconsin. They have since recovered. Do you expect that we'll see more cases of it here?
You know, I think it's very likely. If Wisconsin mirrors what the rest of the country is seeing, I think it is likely that we will see more cases.
What are you watching for in particular as cases surface?
So I think it's helpful for health systems and the community to monitor epidemiologically what the types of cases are that if they do surface, we can have a better sense of how to prepare. So if this is mostly mild disease, then preparedness takes a different angle. If it's people who need to be hospitalized, then we have to consider other scenarios. So it is very important to keep track of how cases are surfacing, but we are fortunate thus far to have had only the one.
How does COVID-19 differ from the flu?
I think clinically it's very hard to distinguish between the two because mild influenza can look very much like COVID-19 and severe COVID-19 can look very much like complicated influenza. There's also a number of other respiratory viruses that are circulating in the country, which also makes it difficult to distinguish. So having the ability to test people whom we suspect might have COVID-19 is very important.
What are some of the warning signs? What should we watch for with symptoms?
I think the big things are fever, and it can be low-grade fever, cough, and shortness of breath in people. Those are the reasons for when you might want to call your physician to ask for advice and, if necessary, come in to be evaluated.
And if you are evaluated, what does the testing protocol look like here?
So the testing is the two specimens are collected. It's a nasopharyngeal swab and an oropharyngeal swab. There may be additional specimens, but those are the core ones. And then those are sent off for testing.
Where are they sent for testing?
At the moment, they can go to the State Lab of Hygiene here in Madison, which has been a wonderful partner for being able to do timely testing and get results back both to the health system and to the patient. There's a number of other labs that are gearing up to be ready, and they're in various stages of preparation, but it's shortly expected that people could send testing elsewhere too.
How are these tests different than perhaps the test we have for the flu and preparing these tests?
So the specimen collection is really no different. It's the same sort of nasopharyngeal swab largely that you would collect. But if you're suspicious of COVID-19, then the healthcare worker would wear protective equipment in the form of a face shield, a respiratory mask, gowns and gloves in order to protect themselves while they're collecting the specimen. The test itself is, of course, very different because it's geared to detect two very different things, one for COVID-19 and the other, or the virus called SARS-CoV-2.
How certain are the tests once they are back? Do they have a really good level of telling us whether a person has COVID-19?
You know, all of this has come about in a very short frame of time, but I think that the test the State Lab of Hygiene does is very reliable. Other labs I can't speak for. There's a number of different assays that are out there. But largely, I think what is being developed is considered to be reliable testing.
The efficacy is there.
Right. Some of them, positive tests do need to be confirmed by the CDC or other reference labs.
And so those tests would have to then be sent to Atlanta?
For some people, yes.
There has been news about a lack of tests in America. Do we have what we need to test people as here in Wisconsin? Do we have all the tools?
I think we do. It's certainly true that in the beginning, I think there were some lab testing issues that were made it difficult to test people whom clinicians might have thought or considered to have COVID-19. But I think that the criteria that the CDC put out in the beginning were actually very helpful in determining who needed to be tested. And then the revised criteria now do make it more, the testing more accessible. So that's been welcome news as well.
How contagious is COVID-19?
Like any respiratory virus, quite contagious. It doesn't mean that everyone in the house will get infected if there's a case, but about 10 to 15% of people will. It spreads mostly through droplet, but in the healthcare system, it seems possibly through air as well.
Through air, you're saying? Would that mean, so if you have a cluster of people in proximity, a crowd, it could travel in the air?
Yeah, so that's the basis for the recommendation right now that people use in the healthcare system an N95 respirator and the patient is placed in a negative pressure room. Those are all things that we do when we suspect airborne transmission. I think because this is evolving and there's so much that's unknown about how it's transmitted, that's the precautions that you would take to the highest level. They may need to be changed as we learn more about transmission.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. We're getting briefed on the latest on COVID-19. You can join in with your questions. Are you concerned about how the U.S. is approaching COVID-19? Have you been taking precautions because of the epidemic at work, at home? What changes have you made to your lifestyle? Are you concerned about getting misinformation? Tell us your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mark now in Hartford. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I don't know. I'm trying not to buy into the hype, but I have started buying a few things, you know, non-perishables and even a couple extra rolls of toilet paper and some, you know, restocking my medicine cabinet and that kind of stuff, just in case. I get sick really easy, so I figured I'd rather be safe than sorry in these cases.
I guess my question is there a concern of, you know, kind of some of the issues that people are reporting in China of running out of toilet paper or all those kind of hype things, and is that something that we should be preparing for?
I think in general it's a good idea to be prepared in the sense that were you to get, you know, say mild disease and you needed to self-isolate at home, it's good to have supplies handy so that you don't have to go out into the public when you are ill. I think panic buying is a real problem because it means that supplies run out when they need to be used, particularly for the care of sick patients. But having said that, you know, a level of preparedness where you have non-perishables, some household supplies and some hand sanitizer or soap and water in reasonable amounts is not a bad idea.
We've heard it countless times that washing your hands is one of the best and easiest ways to protect yourself from infection. What should we know there, and what else can you tell people about prevention and some hygiene?
So I think the usual things that we tell people about prevention of any respiratory virus also holds true for COVID-19. So respiratory etiquette, meaning that you sneeze into your elbow or into a tissue and you discard the tissue right away. That if you are sick, you avoid going out in public to avoid exposing other people, and that you wash your hands frequently, and whether it's hand sanitizer or soap and water, both are effective, so whatever is available will work.
So very similar to what we've heard about to stop the spread of flu, for instance.
Right.
Well, let's take another call now. Trina is here from Black River Falls. Hi, Trina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My husband works in the Lisbon Corrections. I'm just wondering if the coronavirus would show up in the state prison, what problems been handled.
Yeah. So I think that, every entity is developing its own preparedness planning to consider all possible scenarios. What would happen if it were one case? What would happen if there were more cases? How to protect the workers there, as well as the people that might get sick from it. And so some entities are sort of further along with their preparedness plans than others, but everyone is developing theirs, and the specifics of it will look very different depending upon the setting.
Trina, thank you for the call. You know, the death rate, the World Health Organization reported this week, the virus has a fatality rate of 3.4%. The seasonal flu fatality rate is under 1% usually. Yeah. Why is coronavirus much more lethal?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that many respiratory viruses tend to show up in their worst form in people who have illnesses, who may be immunocompromised, who have complex medical conditions, and those are the people where the fatality rate may be higher than in the general public. There's also no currently widely available treatment for COVID-19, whereas there is for influenza, and that also might have a role to play here.
Are we looking at that, treatment options? Is it way too early to talk about that type of research?
No, there is active research going on in multiple sites here in the U.S. and in China. There are investigational agents that are being tested. I think it is too early to say whether they work or not, because these are randomized trials and we won't know until the enrollment is done. But it's very welcome news that in this accelerated timeline, these things could be tested.
What should you know if you're pregnant?
I think if you're pregnant, it would be very similar to what we recommend for people with regards to influenza. And I just want to also remind people that even though we're talking about COVID-19, this is influenza season as well, and there's a lot of those cases going around. So pregnant women in particular need to be vaccinated and then practice the respiratory etiquette precautions we just mentioned. It's also important for them to call their physician should they get any symptoms of a respiratory illness, because mild symptoms in other people may manifest more severely in pregnancy.
Do we know, is there any research out there on the outcomes of these babies if a pregnant woman does have COVID-19?
I think there isn't any specific data that I'm aware of for COVID-19. I think if we generalize from influenza to this, the impact is mostly on the mother. If the mother recovers, the baby's okay.
We're talking with epidemiologist Nasia Safdar from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're learning about the global coronavirus outbreak, how Wisconsin is preparing. Scientists are still trying to pin down the answer to a basic question: how deadly is this virus? And estimates have varied widely. We're getting to the bottom of what is known with your questions front and center. Are you concerned about the coronavirus epidemic and want to know what precautions you should take? What symptoms be watching for? Do you think COVID-19 has been blown out of proportion, or do you feel the U.S. is ill-prepared for a major outbreak? And what about Wisconsin? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Email your questions to ideas@WPR.org. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent talking about the coronavirus outbreak. California is now under a state of emergency, the U.S. confirming its 11th death from COVID-19 yesterday, along with more than 150 confirmed cases. Health experts have warned that the country may struggle to rapidly test thousands of Americans. And at a briefing yesterday at the White House, Vice President Mike Pence said the elderly are the most vulnerable.
The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services has issued new guidelines for nursing homes nationwide. We have raised the bar regarding infectious disease control at our nursing homes.
He went on to say all inspection funding at long-term care facilities will be redirected toward compliance with infection control standards. Still time for your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Let's take another call now. Peter is with us from Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
What is your question?
Well, I'm wondering, my wife and I have travel planned for spring break, and we'll be going from, you know, Appleton to Phoenix through Chicago, right? And so I'm just wondering what your guest thinks about, you know, vacation travel domestically. Is this a time to cancel in advance? You know, we're talking end of March, because it's really uncertain what's going to happen here, but undoubtedly there'll be more cases.
I think that in the immediate future, you know, we're likely to see more cases. So even though there is no sort of official advisory on domestic travel, I think it becomes a very personal decision. But the things to be considered are whether one is healthy or whether there's immune compromise or complex medical conditions in the individuals who are traveling. There also may be flight redirections and changes. And, of course, one cannot control who one sits next to or close to on a flight. And with respiratory virus season, it is likely that there will be some people who are sick and you won't know what they have. And so it's hard to give definitive advice, but those are the things to think about.
Peter, thank you. Let's go to Marina now in Milwaukee. Marina, hi.
Hi. My husband recently was tested for flu. He went to urgent care, and he was charged $300 for this test. So I wonder if this COVID test is free, or is there going to be charge involved? Because that might keep some people away from going to be tested.
Absolutely. I think for the vast majority of people, it will be fee exempt, but it really depends upon where the testing is being sent and what the relationship of the health system is with that entity. So it is a good idea to ask up front what the expected costs of that will be.
Yeah, because some people may not go to get any testing or to go and seek treatment if they don't have insurance or they know that they're going to have to pay something.
Yes, it's possible. And I think those are things that should be worked out between the health systems and their patient population to make sure that no one who should be evaluated is turned away simply because of an inability to afford the test.
Let's go to Victor now in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Hi. Hey, my wife was reading last night that you got the American Cup 2020 coming to the Pfizer Arena this weekend, and some of the participants are from China, Italy, and different Japan. What kind of precautions are going to be taken so we don't get infected here in Wisconsin?
I think that, you know, keeping things in perspective in terms of whether events should be canceled or should continue really depends upon what you're seeing locally in our communities. And at the moment, at least, based on the testing that has been done, there does not appear to be any community transmission of COVID-19. So it's really a public health decision about these things. But in terms of people gathering for conventions and the like, I think the things that we would recommend is having a ready supply of soap and water and hand sanitizer, encouraging people not to be present there if they have respiratory symptoms, and in general, practicing the kind of respiratory etiquette that we recommend for influenza season.
Speaking of hand sanitizer, Sandy emailed to ask for more clarification on whether hand sanitizers are effective or not. Will hand sanitizer help with COVID-19?
Yes, hand sanitizers are effective against COVID-19, and so is soap and water hand washing. It is important to use the correct technique and to do it for 20 seconds with either soap and water or hand sanitizer.
Could COVID-19 fade this spring but then return next winter like what happened with the 1918 flu epidemic?
I think it is a bit humbling to discover that despite the advances in scientific knowledge, we really don't know what viruses will do from one season to the next. So the thing that we're doing, I think, is to learn from what's being described elsewhere and to just prepare that it may remain, it may escalate, or it may, in fact, fade away and become another respiratory virus down the road like some others have in the past. But at this point, I don't think we can say that.
And we can't, we don't even know how it could change or morph into something else. And then we have to develop a whole new treatment protocol or testing protocol?
I think as clinical trials get underway for therapeutics, I think that there might be some opportunities there to change the course of history with this.
Let's go to Kenneth now in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Yeah, I guess I feel it's been overblown.
We're having a hard time understanding you, Kenneth, but I think, go ahead.
Yes, I feel it's been overblown because the president referenced the 29,000 regular flu, and that could be blown into a crisis by the media. And the problem is people are sick and go to work, both in China and in this country, and that should be what should be repeated consistently.
Kenneth, thank you. Is this overblown, or are you seeing reports that are escalating too much in the media?
I think there is a fine line between giving the public accurate information and recommending preparedness versus fanning fear and panic, which is really unnecessary and counterproductive to what public health and infectious diseases recommends and does. I think that the reason people are understandably afraid is that this is novel. We've never seen anything like this before, and we don't know what to expect. And in those circumstances, people tend to imagine the worst possible scenarios. But the caller is correct. I mean, this is influenza season, and influenza is something that, despite decades of familiarity with, still takes a number of lives each year.
And at the same time, public health officials have to think about every different type of scenario as well. So that too can perhaps make people feel really at unease.
Certainly, yes. I think when we talk about preparedness, we're thinking about all possible scenarios. And some of those are not necessarily scenarios that we hope for, but it's better to be prepared and not have to act on it than the other way around.
Are children and the elderly at greater risk? What do we know about those populations?
So elderly, I would say yes, because generally that comes with having more comorbid illnesses and complex medical conditions. So certainly anybody that's immunocompromised is at risk. Children have, for COVID-19, not necessarily been determined to be a high-risk group, but I think the issue comes in that children generally tend to get more respiratory virus infections, and it is very hard to distinguish which is which.
How do quarantines for this virus work?
So quarantine is practiced for a well individual who is segregated in the sense that they are not having any physical contact with other individuals, so that in the event that they were to become sick, they would not transmit it inadvertently.
Do you envision the possibility that healthy people will need to self-quarantine?
I think it depends where we see transmission of this happening. At the moment, you know, people coming back from high-risk countries in some settings are being asked, and high-risk countries are being defined as those that are seeing a number of cases of COVID-19. They're asked to quarantine themselves for 2 weeks for the incubation period, and then they're well, then they'd go out into the public. And it's just another social distancing measure that has been effective in terms of trying to prevent person-to-person transmission.
How are healthcare workers at risk?
So healthcare workers are at risk because they're at the front lines of evaluating and caring for patients. And when somebody comes in with respiratory virus illness, you don't necessarily know what virus they have and whether it's COVID-19 or not. They are also at risk because even though the personal protective equipment that is recommended in these settings works, there might be issue with supply chain and having adequate supplies as this develops further. And if it does, those are some of the preparedness things we'd like to do.
From what you see right now, does Wisconsin have enough respirators to treat serious cases for the illness?
I think I would say at this point, yes. I think it depends where we see this going. If there's, you know, a handful of cases, I think that our current supply and our current preparedness will be fine. I think if there's a surge, then no one entity will be prepared, but together we will be.
Dr. Safdar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is a professor of infectious disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's medical director of infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Just ahead, we talk with an author about a book on the Milwaukee Bucks' 1971 season when the team made an improbable run for the championship and won. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.